Hi everyone, Ed here. GeoMob has been growing, and with it the cost to keep the operation running. So as we discussed earlier this year, we're going to start experimenting with relevant ads here on the podcast. I don't think we could get more relevant than our first advertiser, B-Maps, powered by HiveMapper. So you may recall HiveMapper CEO Ariel was a guest here on the podcast back in episode 179. Here's the deal. Your map is only as good as its data. Without fresh data, a map isn't smart. It's stale. B-Maps is here to help. Since 2023, they've mapped 350 million kilometers of roads with dash cams that were designed for mapping. B-Maps offers simple APIs to access all that imagery, or just the map features you care about. With B-Maps, you can see roads as they exist today without collecting your own data or compromising on quality. Three of the top 10 global map makers use B-Maps to keep their maps fresh. Try it for yourself today, and you'll get 50% off API credits through December 31st with promo code GEOMOB. Just visit bmaps.com/geomob. That's BEEmaps.com/geomob. A big thank you to BMaps for sponsoring the show. Now on to the episode. Welcome to the GeoMob podcast, where we discuss geo innovation in any and all forms, whether for fun or profit.
Welcome back to another GeoMob podcast episode. Today I'm speaking with someone who I've wanted to speak with on a podcast for a while now. As you'll hear, he's an Australian Earth Observation Scientist working for a national government organization. And he's also involved in an international program to look at how we can use geospatial to minimize the degradation of our land. Neil Sims, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Alistair. Good day, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. So, as is always the case with all podcasts around the world that have a guest, can you just quickly introduce yourself and tell us about your pathway into and through both geospatial and Earth observation, I guess?
Yeah, sure. So, Neil Sims is my name, and I work at the Commonwealth Science and Industrial Research Organisation, CSIRO, which is Australia's government national science organisation. How it all started was I actually, took a gap year of about 4 years after I left sort of high school and pondered what I wanted to do. And I've always loved working, with the environment. I've loved it. Actually started because, we used to go camping with my dad in these amazing places. And I just loved it. I loved that, the sort of natural ecosystems, even though most of them, of course, weren't natural. It was, dams and things like that. But it was always lovely to be outside. And then when I went back to uni, so I studied environmental science when I came back to university. And there were a couple of themes that you could take, right? There was kind of a vegetation one and a water one. And I took the water theme, actually, seemed to be a bit, more opportunities, actually, to work in that sort of field in Australia. And really that was about sort of hydrology, water resources management, but also very strongly on the ecology of freshwater ecosystems in particular.
And okay, because I guess in Australia, sorry to interject, but guess in Australia, hydrology and in particular water resources, making sure there's enough water in light of everything that's happening with climate change is obviously a massive deal.
Well, absolutely. Australia is one of the driest countries in the world, and we've got the most variable river hydrology. So you get these long periods of time with no river flow, and then you get these incredible floods that just inundate lots of the landscape. Cool. And those dynamics have a special impact, of course, on the landscape structure and the geomorphology and all of those kind of things. Yeah. I totally find it fascinating. As part of my undergrad studies, we did this unit in Earth observation using satellite imagery. And, of course, at that time, this was 1995, right? And so it was, you got an image from somewhere, you process it to remove most of the stuff you didn't want to see. You process it to show what you wanted to see, and then you interrogated it and correlated it with as many other sort of variables as you could find. And what I really loved about the EO thing, well, for a start, seeing some of the landscapes in Australia in false colour, just they're beautiful, right? It's beautiful images. And so I really loved that. And I've got a little bit of an artistic, I'm not much of an artist, but I like the visual element of things. And so that was a great addition there. But also, the I'm not very mathematical either, but I seem to be able to get my head around numbers in an array representing something that was measured from a satellite, you know, to show differences in composition and structure across an area. And so that was kind of complex enough for me, and I really enjoyed the flexibility of the Earth observation processing and the physics of it and just the beauty of it. And so I chose Earth observation for my honours project. And so my honours project was basically using a time series of, at that time, Landsat MSS images. You remember that one? 90 megapixels and four bands or something. To look at a wetland. And wetlands are really interesting places, you know, that interface between land and water. Sometimes you look at them, they're water, sometimes you look at them at their land. That interaction between the terrestrial sort of functions and the dynamics of a very variable hydrology result in this really complex and dynamic ecosystems functioning, right? And so my honours project there was really looking at this hydrology of one of the main rivers that feeds a lot of agricultural areas in Australia and the structure and functioning of this wetland that lies at the end of it. This is a weird little wetland. We have rivers in Australia we call endorheic. They don't go to the sea. They drain inland. And this great big wetland is one of those ecosystems.
Oh, that sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it's unique, and it was really interesting. Very pretty clunky image processing, right? But it was, you know, 1996 or whatever.
I was going to say, for the younger listeners, like MSS, that's a real challenge to get that, A, get that, B, process it, and C, get meaningful results out of it. I mean, it's nothing like today where you're just getting loads and loads of high-resolution multi-band data coming down.
So, no, you're exactly right. No, thank you. It was really fascinating, actually. It was one of these really early software systems that we used. And what you had to do was, you know, download the image and process it, set the coding up, sort of, you know, as late as you could in the day, go home, you know, do all your thing, come back, and maybe in the morning it was processed as you were expecting it. yes. And maybe not, and maybe you had to restart again. But it was fantastic. And look, that really, the Landsat program, of course, was foundational for making time series data sets available, right? And that's a totally different game now, of course, because they're all open and free. But back in those days, we had to buy them. But you could still get, you know, images that were fairly consistent over time. And that was just an absolute revelation for understanding the structure and function of our ecosystems. And so I ended up working in that company for a little. There was a company that was run out of the university that sort of serviced the agriculture industry. And I spent a lot of time, you know, delineating cotton farms in Landsat images and stuff like that. And that was interesting work, actually, very good. And then I was offered a PhD and that was, again, a floodplain project. Yeah. So great big floodplain, 100 and something k's long and about 40 k's wide, great big cotton farm in the middle of it. And the job there was to, again, have a look at how the river flow influenced the landscape structure and the productivity dynamics and kind of the ecosystem functioning of that whole great big system and see if you could sort of even define it as an ecosystem. And so that was 14 Landsat images that we collected, you know. When we collected those images, it first interrogated the hydrology, and so we picked these images based on what they showed in terms of the hydrology of this land, of the floodplain. And then so we had these different impressions, different seasons, and that let us all do kinds of, you know, all kinds of funky aggregation things. But again, we had to buy those images. That was $45,000 worth in about 1998. That was a lot of money, and you had to pick the bands. You could eliminate bands. You could make your image cheaper by just getting, you know, the NIR and the red band, you know, stuff like that. You may recall those times. So that was really good, and so really that kind of linking hydrology to ecosystem structure and functioning and using the Earth observation imagery to really map that and show it to people who even lived on these places and had never understood the larger scale context, you know, of what they were sort of living on even in those days was really fantastic. And so that's something, that link between the ecology and the earth observation stuff really has underpinned everything I've done sort of since then.
No. So just like when you're talking about ecosystem structure and ecosystems thinking and how you link it with imagery,
are you
talking about species level, or are we talking about sort of wider habitat level, or are we even talking just about whether it's a tree or a bush or a grass?
Yeah. Well, typically, the kind of things we were looking for when we're doing like a sort of an ecosystem study, we call it communities. So, an overstory vegetation type that is usually allied with an understory or a midstory structure, right? So these community levels. Species, as you know, are pretty hard to identify, even with very high quality information, data, very high resolution hyperspectral data. So yeah, community levels. But one of the things that happened when I got a job, I was super lucky, and I'd thought maybe if I go out and work for 10 years and build up my skills, I'll get a job at CSIRO. And I just happened to be offered a job at CSIRO while I was finishing my PhD. And I went, man, I'm the luckiest man alive, right? So it was absolutely phenomenal. And there I actually started in the forestry division, and my job there was to use very high resolution, typically airborne, four-band data, to map diseases and pests in plantation trees. So, we didn't worry about species there because we were working typically in pine forests, right? You knew what the species was. What you were trying to do there was find where trees or regions were maybe not being as productive as they could be. And that was a fantastic link. That was fantastic, linking the on-ground experience of, walking around, finding out where you were in a very high-resolution image, and then interrogating that to show sort of variations in productivity. Interesting that I learned some lessons about the complexities and perhaps some of the downsides of using high-resolution data through that process as well. And I'm going to reveal something to you that, I want the listeners to take note of. I believe I invented a term called mislocation. I can't find it in any dictionary, but it's where you're pretty confident you know exactly where you are on the ground, but you're actually not there. You're somewhere else. And that's because you're standing next to a tree that you think is the tree that you can see on an image, and you go, yep, this is where I am. And so you record all this data about the tree, but you're actually sort of somewhere else. So that's more
you
of
heard
a problem
it here for first folks.
break that one. So that was really, really fascinating. And then high resolution airborne data. We had in our team in CSIRO guys who were developing some of the very first terrestrial LIDAR systems. The challenge was that we were getting airborne LIDAR and we didn't have any way to validate it on the ground, right? So these guys in my lab were making the Echidna system and other ones that were doing really early. So this was 2003 we were making those. And I was still working in the forestry thing. It was really fascinating. And then Hyperion came along, and man, that was a lesson as well. Back in those days when you used to have to get an image and process it to remove all of that scunge in there so you could actually get to what it was that you were doing, you still had to do that. And Hyperion was a great test of that because it was an opportunistic instrument. It was a test instrument. We were amongst the highest users globally, but man, we learned a lot about the hyperspectral image processing and what it could show there. And that really changed my thinking around the processing. So we started to get into machine learning things then, and started to get into these other modeling methods that were really good for when you've got 250 bands.
I think it's really interesting that back in those times, we were looking at, like you say, machine learning models and hyperspectral data sets. And it sort of went very quiet then through the 2010s. And it seems to be coming back now. There's talk of more hyperspectral stuff. And obviously, there's all the AI explosion, machine learning explosion that's coming as well. And I always had the impression that CSIRO really led the way in a lot of Earth observation stuff in terms of techniques. I guess because Australia is so massive, it's the obvious tool to use. But did you, at the time, did you have that feeling that you were really pushing the boundaries?
Yeah, look, to be fair, I wasn't really aware of what was going on in other countries. I just knew every time we went somewhere, people went, wow, man, that's amazing, you know? So, we've always had a great relationship formally between the Australian government and the United States government, particularly the USGS, right, around Landsat. So Australia had some of the very earliest archives of Landsat imagery, and so we've been able to use that. We've also, in CSIRO, we've had historically at least, we had a very strong link to industry partners, and so the forestry industry was coming up to us basically saying, dudes, I want to just check if my trees are growing as quickly as they can. How can we do this? And so we had this really nice relationship with those guys who were telling us, you know, genuine problems that we thought we could address. And so we had this guidance from the industry partners. We had great sort of scientific opportunities and then, really lots of sort of scope to get data and support from the United States to in particular do that. With the Hyperion thing, it turned out that we ended up being very advanced users of that data. And again, that was a little bit of a surprise to me, but it was a really interesting time. And I think those foundational skills in EO, understanding, you know, how much work goes into getting something ARD, right? And the luxury now of just being able to go cloud and go, dude, just give me all the ARD data you've got for this thing forever. Wow, that's totally changed the game.
Yeah, definitely. Right, we do need to move on and talk about the topic of the podcast, which is land degradation. And I was just wondering, before we really get into the nuts and bolts about it, could you quickly explain the difference between three different concepts? So there's land degradation neutrality, there's GOLDN, and there's SDG 15.3.1. They're very different things, and they get bandied around a lot in this area, I know. But could you just quickly give us a sort of dictionary definition of those three?
All right, I'll do my best. It does get complex, I'll do my best. So, you know, the sustainable development goals have this particular structure where they've got the goals, which is kind of a theme. So the goal 15 is life on land, right? And then there's targets sitting under that. That's kind of what you're aiming to improve. So target 15.3 It basically describes living in this land degradation neutral world. What that means is essentially the countries will develop some areas, they'll restore some areas, they'll conserve some areas, and the basic mission is to not increase the total extent of degraded land in each country above the extent that was observed in 2015. And that year is picked for a couple of reasons. One, it's when the SDGs came into effect. And the second one is that we've got about 15 years of MODIS data before that, you know, from 2000, right? And in highly variable systems, about 15 years of observations is usually long enough to encounter most of the variability that you're going to see in a system. So that's a good amount of time, you know, to have a look. That might be changing with climate change now, of course, everything is. But, you know, back when we wrote the methods, that was the plan. So land degradation neutrality is that integrated land use planning framework that is built around target 15.3. It is about well integrated globally. It's the UNCCD, the Convention to Combat Desertification, are the custodians, and we'll probably hear more about them a bit later on. Now, the way we measure land degradation for LDN and for target 15.3 is using an indicator, so it's a goal target indicator, and there's only one indicator for this, and it is the proportion of land that is degraded over total land area. And that is a binary measure, right? So things are either degraded or they're not. What we do is we look at three it's a bit jargonistic, but the three what we call sub-indicators. One is land cover and land cover change. One is land productivity dynamics. And another is carbon stocks above and below ground. And for that, we usually use soil organic carbon. And then there's all these funky ways to assess the dynamics of land productivity that are kind of on top of that. Those three indicators and that definition of degradation that we have to use for this were given to us through the UNCCD. We don't have any. There's a long process to go through that definition, right? You cannot change that in from my position. So those three sub-indicators, land cover is a sort of a classified variable, what do they call it, a categorical variable, right? Land productivity is a fast response ecological variable, and that's you know, measurements of things like NDVI or whatever over whole countries. They typically have the most influence on the apparent extent of degradation. And then carbon stocks is a slow-moving ecological response variable. So you get these different time scales and different kind of data types being incorporated into the assessment of land degradation. So that's LDN framework and the indicator. So that's what we measure. GOLDN, what the UNCCD were really hoping to do is get actual support from international organisations to implement LDN. GEO, the Group on Earth Observations, was kind of an obvious target. And in 2018, I think it was, I was at the meeting with one of the guys from the UNCCD, and we kind of stood up and made an intervention. Hey, we've got this LDN thing going on. Is it possible for GEO to give us a hand, you know, build some resources? And so they did that. And I happened to have co-led the GEO LDN activity in GEO since that time. And really what that is, it's a place to connect countries who want to improve their reporting on land degradation or want to set land degradation neutrality targets to technologies that can help them calculate things and also to expertise in the calculation of it. So it's still very Earth observation focused, but that model of connecting, you know, the UNCCD people who are very strongly backing this, the analytics that have come in from CSIRO and the GOLDN, which has a permanent secretariat sponsored by the GIZ in Germany, has made it a very effective combination. So in the SDG system, indicator 15.3.1 is about one of the most reported indicators.
Oh, excellent.
There's about 121 countries setting land degradation neutrality targets and about 140 countries reporting on the indicator. And that GOLDN program really gets them talking together and provides those tools and things for them there. Is that about
Brilliant.
Right?
That's amazing. Okay. Thank you. That was really clear at breaking all those things down. I guess from what you've said, the obvious thing to then point out is that it's not just a technical issue. It's not a case of, oh, we've got these three sub-indicators, bosh them out for the entire world, do a little bit of stuff on the cloud and hooray, it's all done. It's not only is it a massively political issue, but there's a lot of sort of academic thought that needs to go into deciding for different environments and different countries, what is degradation? Like, how do you even define that word? And then how do you find the right data to generate the right indices that you need for those sub-indicators and then report
exactly.
them? So the fact it's doing so well is a brilliant testament, I think, to the entire program and the fact that everyone is working together. Could you maybe just talk a little bit about some of the issues around the data? So, for instance, you might have a country that's as big as Brazil, but you might also have something that's as small as Western Samoa. How do those two countries deal with trying to report on effectively the same types of indices?
Yeah, look, that's a really great question. What we tried to do with the methods, you know, we recognized really early on that countries like Australia have a great deal of capacity and experience and access to skills and infrastructure to be able to, you know, capture and process their data sets, including Earth observation data, and some other countries don't have that, right? So one of the things, for example, when we were writing the methods for the land productivity part, I suggested that we use NDVI. You can basically get your NDVI from toasters nowadays, right? Like it comes from everything, right? Yeah. And the advantage of that is that I wanted I wanted every country to be able to measure their land productivity fairly consistently across the globe using whatever they could get. Okay, and so people were surprised about that because there are many more advanced methods out there, but the NDVI and that kind of thing works okay. So consistency was an important part of that, but there's also accessibility to the tools. So Brazil and China and the Cook Islands and Australia all have different challenges actually, and so accessibility to the people in the GOLDN network, for example, and accessibility to the data. And the processing, tools, we try to provide that and maximize the opportunities for every country to get the kind of resources and support that they need, including on the data processing and analytics itself. But, all of those fair and open processes as well, everything that we do here is pretty much supplied to whoever wants it at no cost, right? So it's really trying to be very, very open. And the final part there is that in the SDG process, so there are these global data sets that the UNCCD uses, these default ones, to sort of estimate your country's land degradation, right? And that uses the methods that we wrote, and it's pretty good. I'm pretty happy with it, but lots of people aren't. Right, that you, as you were saying before, I don't think any two humans agree on what the definition of land degradation is, and there's a number of other things there. So that's one of the reasons why we left the definition alone. But essentially, the program itself in the SDG process is very sort of adaptable. So it says, well, here's these three, this is the way to measure land degradation and the way we want it to be reported into the UNCCD. And actually, though, if you've got something that does the same job and you can sort of align it with what we're, with the SDG methods, the formal methods, that'll probably work well as well. And so countries get the opportunity to basically say, we are mapping land degradation in a way that's consistent with the SDGs, but not using exactly those data sets that have been recommended. Here's how it works, and this is the way that our country has agreed to sort of report on land degradation. So each country has the opportunity to adapt things a little bit. We're actually going through that process right now in Australia, and I think the process of getting an agreement amongst the government agencies on what data sets to use for this indicator is as much of a task or as challenging a task as it would be if we were said we're just going to make new data sets. I think the agreement is really challenging. So you're right, there's politics involved in there too. Did I ask you a question? I think I did.
No, it did. It was really good. So I guess... That then brings up, how does a change get accepted? Is that accepted by UNCCD, or is it accepted by you as the sort of technical lead who wrote the method? So if, for instance, I was reporting for a country and I had my country put up its own national satellite, and there was a big push to use the data from that because we paid for it, and we look at it for land degradation and we think, okay, well, we can definitely get NDVI from it, and we can do a land cover classification from it, and maybe we can get send some people out and they can do soil organic carbon measuring. So those are moving away from your sub-indicators, your default sub-indicators.
Yeah.
How do I, as the reporter for that country, get someone to accept that that's what we're going to do? Or is it just a case of... it's my prerogative from that country?
Fairly much. You have to. The way I think it works is, you know, the reports go to the UNCCD. The UNCCD people collate all those reports and look at them all, right? And they sort of have and they'll ask questions. They'll get back to you and ask questions. I helped out with the Australian report last time, and basically what we did was the default data came our way. It showed a pattern of distribution of degradation that we weren't entirely convinced by. So we basically wrote back and said, look, we can't do a better job at the moment, but here's where I think this doesn't fit for Australia, right, and why. And so that process can happen. There are also very formal processes to implement the methods, and that's the process that we went through when we got the contract to write the methods for the indicator. So the UNCCD had this indicator they were looking after. It wasn't formalised. There weren't formal methods, and countries weren't reporting on it. So they came somehow to CSIRO and said, write some methods for us. We wrote the methods, and then there's a formal process, what's called the Interagency Expert Group on SDGs, the IAEG, part of the UN Statistics Division, and they actually formally check the statistical rigor of what you're providing, and then then adopt that as part of the formal methods process. Now, that involves, a slight aside here, that involves having the custodian agency on board and having good statistical information on board and a really good processes to implement to go up that chain from methods to custodian agency to the IAEG. And one of the reasons I think that we've been very successful in this game, in the LDN and 15.3.1 game, is we do have very integrated connection representation from the UNCCD on everything that we're doing. So when we change the methods here, that actually can be formalized and adopted by the custodian agency who's got to collate the reports, and then that gets developed as part of the process. Now, for other indicators, often there's this great big distance between the custodian agency and people trying to develop methods that really are good for reporting on the indicator, and it makes it much more difficult to get that kind of deep traction into the formal sort of metadata methods than we have the opportunity to do here. So I think that's one of the secrets to the success of what we're doing here, that close integration of all of those partners.
Excellent, yeah. So taking on that point about the close integration of the partners and the fact that you've got global success in terms of reporting, I mean, it seems to me that there's a lot of positive feeling towards the whole issue of reporting on LDN. And I, for full transparency, I have done a little bit of work tangentially to the stuff you're doing, but I've had to engage with people who are doing reporting and data collating from different countries. And it didn't matter where in the world you were coming from, everybody could see the benefit of this, and everybody had an opinion, but not a sort of shouty opinion like you get on the internet, but really good opinions about science and reporting and everything else. So I just wanted to make sure that listeners understood that this is a UN program that's being sort of rolled out, but there's so much engagement, and it's so heartening to see people using Earth observation daily and using it in a way that's, you know, for the benefit of the planet. So, I think it's a really good system.
Yeah, thanks, Alistair. And I do, your work was actually really important to setting, to the increasing the flexibility and the adaptability of the work that we're doing here. So very quickly on that, of course, what we do is rather than prescribe countries should use a particular data set, what we did and what you helped with, Alistair, was, of course, defining those standards for data so that when new data sets become available, we can check whether they're going to be suitable for LDN or not. Brilliant, right? Nice and flexible, keeps everything agile. So that's really good. Certainly, I've had some fantastic opportunities in CSIRO, and I've loved many elements of my work. I like this the best because the people we work with are just great, and that is the foundation of the enjoyment of everything. It doesn't, if you're trying to save the world with people you don't like it, it's no cool, right? If you're cleaning exactly. out the horse stables with people you're having a great time with, you can be having a ball, you know? Yeah. Same applies at any level. And so we've had this really fantastic bunch of people to work with, but this really – you know, it's an issue that people can get traction with. You know, you stand on land wherever you are and seeing how that's changing over time and thinking about the consequences of that change for you, your neighbours, your region, your country and the planet is something people sort of understand, right? It's a bit easier than climate change sometimes, right?
Yeah.
So, so that's something we've had traction with. And also, you know, those interconnected elements and the activities of the GOLDN in particular, at the GO conference in Cape Town in October last year, we kind of asked countries, you know, if you want to send a team, us guys will be hanging out at a hotel near GO, you know, come and have a talk to us. We could fit about 15 countries in the room, but we got applications from 44 countries to come and visit us. Man, like awesome. We didn't really know what to do, right? So we had to go through this really rigorous process of identifying who would come there. And it was just such a great that the feeling of we're in this together, the demonstrations of one country to another saying, this is my challenge, can you give me a hand with it? The challenge for some countries was, you know, the politics of tenure, right? Land tenure issues in this area that they wanted to restore was part of the problem. Other countries didn't have a land cover map, you know. Right. So really, really diverse challenges. That's but really it's so great. We're in this to, you know, because we've got this expertise and all that, and that's fantastic. But basically, we're here to just do good. And it, to me, it's the most enjoyable part of my working life. It's fantastic.
That's excellent. Yeah. So much has changed in terms of technology and society and obviously climate since the SDGs were signed into being. How do we continue to keep this work relevant as we approach 2030, 2050 and beyond? I'm hoping this will, as an initiative, this will carry on because it's doing so well at the moment.
Yeah, thank you. No, it's a really interesting question, and one that is actually being thought about quite now. Of course, the SDG process is due to end in 2030, right? And so what happens after that? So maybe some of the elements of what we're measuring may change. I mean, new data sets will come along, new analytics, that's inevitable, right? I think if I was going to guess, I'd say maybe some of the indicator methods are going to change, but I think that the targets will continue. So I think something like land degradation neutrality will go beyond 2030, right? Now, there's actually a process that we're working with at the moment in the IAEG, those statistics people in the UN, really Earth observation could contribute to increasing the reporting on lots of different SDGs. One of the problems with some of the indicators is that they require data sets that are very difficult to get, sometimes some things around tenure, for example, things like that, right? So there's a process, a discussion going on at the moment. Antonio Guterres basically said, guys, we've got to rescue the SDGs, right? That was his language. And so there's a proposal at the moment to say, what we need to do, have a look at the metadata for some of these indicators and maybe eliminate some of these data sets that are preventing countries reporting on them. And maybe there's more things we can add from an Earth observation perspective to supplement or complement that. So how can we use the Earth observation technologies to increase the reporting on a lot of these other indicators? And I think that process is one of the ways that we get nicely integrated, you know, for EO into the future of whatever the SDGs become. And then, of course, there's some amazing new missions coming up, right? Earth observation missions. And so programs like Landsat Next, for example, which seems super exciting, right? To me, it seems like a really good balance of temporal, spectral, and spatial resolution. Yeah. Well, let's get on board with, you know, developing methods that will be suitable to create the products that we need from that data now. So we start building up those kind of skills and, you know, and the technologies, and we start developing those conversations around what land degradation products can we make from something like Landsat Next data when it comes out. We start that conversation now, and then that sort of carries us on to the future. But I think you're right. I mean, tragically, and it really, you know, the news around our environment, it can weigh you down, man, right? There's a lot of poor news out there. And I've been working in the climate space recently, and it's the worst there probably, right? Yeah. But these issues are not going to go away, right? And our land is the foundation of most people's lives. And so if that's degraded or the good land is getting smaller in area, that's going to have a big impact on us, dude, from things like climate change and all these other bulldozers and things that we drive around as well. So those issues aren't going to go away. And I think that the Earth observation contribution to reporting and consistently measuring those things and making that information available to everyone is just going to increase enormously.
That's absolutely brilliant message. Thank you so much for your time today. I think we're going to have to wrap it up there, even though I could carry on talking about this for ages and ages. So how can people get in touch with you if they want to find out more?
Yeah, well, look, I think there may be a couple of links in the show notes.
That's correct, yeah.
But neil.sims@csiro.au, you know, neil.sims. And I'm always super happy to hear from everyone. Alistair, you probably know, you know, I'm very passionate about this. Stopping me talking about it can be the trick. And so if people are interested to learn more, then I'm always super happy to help.
No, that's brilliant. Thank you so much for your time. That's excellent. Cheers, Neil.
No worries. Good on you.
Thanks for joining us today on the GeoMob podcast. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. You can get the show notes over on the website, which is at thegeomob.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter and find links to our accounts on Mastodon and LinkedIn so that you can stay up to date on all our upcoming events. We hope to see you at an event soon.